This is the To The Point podcast. Together with our ERISA attorney, we'll explore key Affordable Care Act and trending compliance topics, all in 15 minutes or less. Now here's our host, Sarah Gillespie.
Hello, and welcome to our To The Point podcast. This is Sarah Gillespie. I'm your host. I'm with Lipscomb & Pitts Insurance in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm the compliance director here. And we are back with Stacey Barrow, our ERISA attorney from Marathis Barrow, Weatherhead, and Lent. Hey, Stacey, how are you?
Good. Hi, Sarah.
So as I had mentioned in another podcast, it's October 2017, and Trump has had a busy October insofar as the ACA is concerned. And we know that ACA repeal was unsuccessful legislatively through the end of September, where the window for a budget reconciliation process was closed. And so interestingly, on October 12th, a couple of things came out. First, there was the executive order that he signed with three particular things. And then there was the announcement that some ACA subsidies would end. So, Stacey, I want to talk to you first about this executive order. So, as I understand it, the order was directing the federal agencies that are in charge of implementing the ACA to propose new regulations. It itself didn't change anything. It directed agencies to reconsider changing things. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The order just kind of directs the agencies that implement the ACA to within between 60 and 120 days, depending on which provision we're talking about, to basically think about drafting or proposing new guidance to expand certain areas of the law, to expand access to health reimbursement arrangements, short-term health insurance plans, and really most significantly, potentially expanding the rights of employers to form associations and potentially buy insurance across state lines.
So can you talk a little bit more about those three things in particular? Why those three things?
Yeah, so why those three things? A good question. I don't think it's a big secret that this administration is somewhat hostile to the Affordable Care Act. And if you would ask me as an ACA expert, what are the three things that I would do if I were trying to dismantle the ACA without having to actually go to Congress and amend the law? Now, what could I do from a regulatory or sub-regulatory standpoint? And really, the three provisions in the executive order are the top three things that would potentially disrupt the Affordable Care Act and frankly, the insurance markets in general.
And so speaking of, you know, the expanded access to association health plans, how would that dismantle the ACA? Maybe you could just break that down for us.
Yeah, so the order itself is pretty brief. It's only a couple of pages, and it doesn't go into a lot of detail, but what it does say, I think, could have a huge impact potentially on employers and folks in the individual market. And so one of the elements that they're proposing here is looking at ways to expand or allow individual and small employers to be treated as large group for ACA purposes. And as you may know, if in the individual market and the small group market, plans are required to offer coverage in all 10 categories of essential health benefits. Once you get to be a large group plan or a self-insured plan, you can pick which of those 10 categories you would like to provide under your plan. So, you know, you could potentially offer a leaner, less expensive plan that might appeal to younger, healthier individuals. And then as part of that, they're looking at potentially expanding the definition of employer under ERISA to possibly allow for associations to be employers for these purposes, making it easier, again, for smaller businesses to be treated as large group, and potentially paving the way for these plans or association plans to be offered across state lines, which, you know, is another issue, you know, depending on how they write these rules, and if they allow associations to offer plans across state lines, it is a weakening of states' regulatory authority over their insurance market. And states, for a long time, have always had a vested interest in protecting their insurance carriers and the insurance market in their state. And so, you know, any new rules regarding associations that attempt to supersede state authority may be met with a challenge from the states. So it's the potential here is very great to make a lot of change and you know, expand these association plans, but it's kind of unclear exactly how the rules will be drafted. One of the things that the order doesn't really spend much time on or really mention at all is that these association plans would still be MEWAs, multiple employer welfare arrangements. And under ERISA, MEWAs are regulated by the states. So, you know, they will be subject to state insurance laws like solvency and licensing requirements. There may be some additional federal burdens like having to file a Form M-1, and we'll just kind of have to wait and see how the Department of Labor moves forward here. But I think they're looking at upending 40 plus years of regulatory guidance that, you know, generally says that the association would not be the employer for ERISA purposes.
Okay, so that definitely would bring about a lot of change. So looking at the short-term insurance, so right now there's a gap of no more than 3 months in coverage that could be allowed before an individual mandate penalty would be assessed. So if short-term insurance was allowed, I think I'm reading or I read somewhere that there was a proposal that short-term could even be 12 months. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that's the second element of the executive order. Under the Obama administration, Obama limited, you know, they're basically mini-med plans, these short-term limited duration plans, and he limited them to 3 months and that they could not be renewable. They basically wanted to make sure that it's just kind of a short-term gap coverage, maybe bridging the gap between jobs or between someone graduating from college and getting employer coverage, because the more people, younger, healthier folks that take these short-term or mini-med type of plans, it pulls the younger, healthier people out of the small group market. And so what the executive order is looking to do is, instead of having them be short-term limited duration plans, they would be longer term and renewable. They'd be able to be purchased for periods of 12 months and they could be renewed. And, you know, one of the criticisms of the ACA was that they got rid of the mini-med plans, and there's certainly a large segment of the population, younger, healthier folks, that they prefer the mini-med plans. They don't need that same robust level of coverage. And of course, the reasoning behind limiting them to these short durations is to make sure that the younger, healthier folks aren't pulling out of the individual and small group markets.
Yeah. And so just as a reminder to our listeners, so a mini-med plan is a plan that is not going to have full-scale major medical coverage. So it might have hospital coverage, but it's limited to a certain dollar amount or a certain number of days or something like that. So there's coverage available, but it's not as extensive as what you would see under a regular major medical plan. And so that's what Stacey's explaining and how it would disrupt the individual market. So, okay, so that's the second one. So health reimbursement arrangements. So how would that impact things if they were expanded?
Sure. So the third provision in the order directs the regulatory agencies within 120 days. This is a little bit longer time frame than the other two, which were 60 days. But within 120 days, the agencies should look at proposing or revising guidance to expand the usability of HRAs, basically. In particular, allowing them to be used to purchase individual market coverage. Back in 2013, and this is an issue that really exposes the Obama administration's reliance on sub-regulatory guidance, something they were criticized for consistently over his terms, and that was by virtue of an IRS notice, the Obama administration restricted the use of health reimbursement arrangements from reimbursing individual market premiums. And, you know, that was, you know, simply a, you know, basically a fiat. There was no real basis in the law for doing that. The administration just felt that it would be beneficial for implementing the ACA if employers couldn't pay for individual market coverage. You know, no real basis in the law to do that. They just did it through an IRS notice. And those kinds of things can be undone very quickly and easily. And out of the three things we're talking about right now on the executive order, this one, frankly, could probably happen the fastest. There are state insurance issues with the first two. You know, we just talked about the short-term limited duration policies. States will also challenge the expansion of those policies as well if they think it's going to be disruptive to their insurance market. But this one with the HRAs, it can pretty much just be undone by an IRS notice, and then employers, if they wanted to, could potentially reimburse individual market coverage through those HRAs.
And I feel like the HRA of the three is the one that seems to be the most real world for our immediate clients as well, because the others are, I don't know, somewhat more 10,000 foot level discussions. But we have had several small employers who were frustrated by that that ruling that they could no longer reimburse individual coverage. So I can see that, you know, you're saying it could happen quickly, and I could see it actually being implemented quickly as well. Well, I want to talk briefly about the announcement, the other one that came out on October 12th from the White House about some of the ACA subsidies ending. And so in particular, we're talking about the cost sharing subsidies. So first, let me clarify that within the exchange, the individual market, there are subsidies for public for coverage under the public exchanges for premium and for cost sharing. So the premium is going to be subsidies that would help pay people's premium, the cost of coverage. The cost sharing reductions are things like deductible, coinsurance, those kinds of things. And so can you explain what happened? It seems like you created a crisis. And was it done on purpose? What can you tell us about all that?
Yeah, it's kind of like a solution in search of a problem. So you explained the nature of the cost sharing reductions. During the Obama administration, the House Republicans sued the Obama administration claiming that those cost sharing reduction payments were illegally funded, that there was not a proper appropriation by Congress to pay for them. The Obama administration had always taken the position that there was a permanent appropriation established for the premium credits, and that employers could just simply, or sorry, that the government could simply pay those cost sharing reduction payments out of the premium reduction, or the premium credit money, because it's all part of the same program. But when the House of Representatives sued a couple of years ago, there was a federal court in Washington, D.C. that found a couple of things. One, that the Republicans actually had standing to sue, which is a little bit unusual. Courts usually don't want to hear disputes between the legislative and executive branch. In other words, they don't want Congress running to the federal court system every time they disagree with the president on a policy issue. The courts routinely have been loath to hear these kinds of arguments. Nonetheless, this one proceeded. So the court found that A, they had standing, and B, they were right that these cost-sharing reduction payments were illegally funded. Now, it's a bit of a results-oriented decision. I think it's a stretch to say that the cost-sharing reduction payments are really divorced from the premium tax credits, but you know that's the judge's decision. And so what happened when Trump won the presidency was, in order to continue making these payments, the president, President Trump, would have to appeal a decision that he agrees with. Like, he doesn't want to fund these either. He calls them bailouts to the insurance companies, which of course is a complete mischaracterization. These are reimbursements to insurance carriers for monies paid out to doctors, to providers. These are monies that the insurance carriers are entitled to under the law. Congress simply has to make an appropriation for them. And so this has been a big stunt for the administration to turn off the spigot here as retaliation, maybe for not getting the ACA repeal passed, and trying to maybe force the Democrats to work with him more on changing the ACA. But what happened was, as a result of the statement on, again, the same day as the executive order, that the payments are going to stop effective immediately, about 20 states, including Massachusetts and California, sued the Trump administration seeking an emergency order requiring the government to make these payments. And they sued in, I think it was the Northern District of California. And just yesterday, that court in California refused, it was actually an Obama appointee judge, they refused to order the Trump administration to make the payments for a couple of reasons. And in one of them, they said, there's still a court case out there that is addressing the constitutionality of these payments, and it hasn't been decided. And the judge actually felt that the Trump administration has the stronger legal argument and that the states are unlikely to prevail on the merits. And then the second reason, which is really kind of funny when you think about it, is he said the fact that the payments aren't being made, I mean, the relief sought by the states essentially would be counterproductive, because what happens when the government refuses to make these payments to the insurance companies, it puts more pressure on the premium tax credit program. And so the effect for the enrollees actually is they will probably fare better when the government doesn't make these cost sharing reduction payments, because the states were smart enough to be prepared for this stunt, and they told the insurance carriers load up all their increases onto the silver plans so they would get the money through the premium tax credit program. So again, this little, you know, I call it a stunt because I'm not sure how to characterize it. You know, it's going to cost taxpayers $200 billion to not pay the money to the insurance companies, because it puts more pressure on the premium tax credit program. So again, we're all paying for this. It's going to be disruptive to the individual market, the small group market, and maybe even the large employer market. But, you know, that's the price to pay when you're saving Americans from the ACA.
Right, right. So is this all just, you know, like you called it a stunt, which I think is a good characterization. Is it to get legislation moving, or, you know, what should employers, who are the ones usually who listen to these podcasts, what should they think about this? This is, you know, kind of affecting the individual market, but, you know, carriers are the ones who provide those individual policies. And if they loaded up their rates, maybe it doesn't mean anything to employer policies. But what would your thoughts or comments be on this for employers?
Well, I think employers generally should be in support of continuing to make these payments. Employers rely on a healthy and viable individual health insurance market. You know, we want to make sure that the individual market is healthy as an alternative to COBRA, to encourage early retirement, to make it easier for our part-time employees who aren't eligible for the group plan to maybe get coverage through the individual market. And as we kind of seen in the past, generally, I think accepted phenomenon is that when there's a lack of public funding, then the providers just increase cost on the private payers, meaning employer plans. So I don't see any benefit to employers, regarding the cessation of these cost sharing reduction payments. And in fact, I think it's only going to serve to increase costs the longer they delay making these payments and disrupt the individual market.
Okay. Your explanations are always helpful. Well, if you have any questions, you want to talk about this further with your Lipscomb and Pitts representative, you can contact me. I can reach out to Stacy if you have other questions. My email is sarahg@lpinsurance.com. Thank you so much for joining us on this podcast. And thank you, Stacy, for a lot of explanation on things going on. I guess there's still wait and see is still the kind of the name of the game. But we always appreciate your input.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Have a great day.